Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. November 30th, that's the day Sacramento City Unified hopes all eligible students and staff will be vaccinated against COVID-19. The district announced this requirement last week. The new rule allows for medical and personal belief exemptions from the mandate. The deadline, however, is 7 months ahead of the state's. And even that July 2022 state mandate has some in an uproar. On Monday, a one-day vaccine protest took place across California, including thousands of students and adults gathered at the state capitol. EdSource tracked attendance across the state for that single day. Attendance was down at Placerville Union School District by 25% and Oroville Union High School District by 40%. So, as with most issues related to COVID, I can imagine Sac City Unified is receiving a wide array of feedback, from two thumbs up to a good amount of questions and pushback. Joining us to explain the new mandate is Sac City Superintendent of Schools, Jorge Aguilar. He'll be answering not only our questions, but also from parents who sent us their own questions. Welcome, Superintendent Aguilar.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, with more than 40,000 students, 4,700 employees in your district, you can't make everyone happy. But with this particular issue, you must have expected and prepared for not even like an either or in response, but a gradient of reaction. So what's unique about Sac City Unified to justify getting ahead of the state by pretty much half a school year with this vaccine mandate for students and staff?
One of the things that I've said often is that I wake up every day with a great deal of anxieties. I'm, of course, briefed by our staff of what things are looking like in terms of COVID and transmission. And one thing that we know about Sacramento is that we still have generally lower vaccination rates in our community, higher transmission rates in our community as well. And as you may have heard, we were on the brink of closing one of our schools. All of those factors came together in a way that I thought was really important for us to revisit and visit this topic. And I think that the board made, of course, a very bold stand to protect public health. The thought is that, of course, there is a way to conquer this pandemic and that a vaccine requirement is a path forward to keeping our schools open and increasing community, given the longstanding effects that this pandemic has now had on a very vulnerable population of students, which is about 72-73% of our overall student population in Sac City Unified.
Can you expand on how the school year has been going so far in terms of COVID transmission and students learning being impacted or interrupted with quarantines?
Well, we've already seen the impact of unfinished learning in the social and emotional well-being of our students, the mental health well-being of our students, the academic, of course, the amount of unfinished learning that has taken place over the course of many, many months. And you see it in their faces. Now, of course, you also see the joy and the happiness of our students being back in space with one another, with their teachers, that they, of course, missed very much. Teachers also missed them, all of our staff. For so many of our students, our schools are safe havens, Vicky, and we have to understand that. And what I've said is that there are, of course, considerations that we had to look into and discuss with the board and our community. But if, in fact, in the future, others in our community and just beyond our community look back and ask why we may have not taken steps to prevent losses in enrollment and other considerations that I'd be happy to discuss with you, it'll be because we took a very firm approach and action to minimize the threat of COVID so that we could continue to serve our students and meet the academic, social and emotional, mental health, nutritional, and so many other needs that our students have in Sac City Unified.
Was attendance at your district impacted by Monday's walkouts at schools across the state?
You know, we reviewed the data and we didn't see a significant drop. We are very fortunate, I think, to have a community that I think understands the importance of making sure that our students are attending in-person instruction, if at all possible. It was a very, very minimal drop in attendance at several of our school sites, but generally we did not see the impact that you mentioned earlier and that I also have read about.
The walkouts, that happened on Monday, they're just really part of a larger conversation that's taking place when it comes to vaccine mandates. What message do you get from these families and school staff?
Well, partly, you know, I've seen and been tracking a lot of the messages that have been coming directly to me, to our district office. And one thing that I do want to clarify is that in our case, it's a vaccination mandate, of course, and we are very firm about it. But at the moment, there are still some exemptions available to families that wish not to provide proof of a vaccination for their child. And so long as those exemptions exist, it is a requirement then that you would undergo routine medical testing for COVID. And so that is a very strong message that we have to make sure people understand. It isn't vaccination or nothing. It's vaccination or an exemption that's filed with the district before we have to then enroll a student in independent study.
So testing requirements will be imposed for children who are exempted from this mandate. Does that expand to school staff?
That's correct. And we've been very fortunate and really proud of the infrastructure that we built in Sac City Unified, where we are providing COVID testing at each of our 75 schools. We have tested many thousands of students and staff and families as well. We have provided vaccination, over 20,000 vaccinations. And we will continue to do it. Every Wednesday, we have vaccination clinics here at Cerna. But those are requirements. And those, again, are the mitigating steps that we are taking to make sure that we are trying to control for the spread of COVID.
Obviously, there's already a list of vaccines that children are required to get before they can attend school. I mean, we're talking measles, mumps, tetanus, et cetera. But COVID vaccines for eligible kids are still awaiting full authorization from the FDA. So currently, those 12 to 15 are under emergency use authorization. This can happen in the coming days or weeks. But what if that doesn't happen by November 30th?
You know, the resolution that I hope that our community and listeners of the show will access is pretty specific in terms of the timelines, but it also provides for some level of discretion and some level of flexibility in the timelines and deadlines, depending on our ability to access testing, our ability to partner for vaccinations, and any kind of changing conditions that might occur between now and then. One thing that I, as superintendent, have realized over the last 18 months or so is with a pandemic, there's so many changing conditions that are ever changing. And we've had to constantly demonstrate our ability to pivot and be agile and nimble. And so we are very respectful and accepting that those are conditions that may continue to change. The resolution does provide for some level of discretion and flexibility for those kinds of extenuating circumstances because of the realization of these ever-changing conditions throughout the pandemic.
So when you're talking about flexibility, hypothetically, if children 12 to 15 are still under emergency use authorization, that flexibility in terms of exemptions would apply to them?
The exemptions do apply, of course, but let me give you another example. We're hearing, of course, of the potential authorization under emergency use for 5 to 11-year-olds. The resolution language allows for some discretion to look at the conditions to determine whether we will implement that part of the vaccination requirement by November 30th or whether we might extend that particular deadline. But the resolution is very clear that the board expects that we will move forward with the vaccination requirement under that type of emergency use.
Do you understand how emergency use authorization could make some parents hesitant, and even if they're fine with measles, mumps, and tetanus vaccines?
And that's exactly why we've allowed for that discretion, Vicki. We want to make sure that our families have a sufficient amount of time to check in with their primary care doctors, to do their own consultations, to do their own research, if you will. So those are the kinds of factors that we will be looking into, as well as, of course, interacting with our families, which we often do as we communicate with them. And again, I'm always receiving email messages and calls to express those views. So we're very respectful of those. And that's why we wanted to make sure that we have some degree of discretion around this topic for that particular population of our students.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sacramento City Unified Superintendent Jorge Aguilar about the district's vaccine mandate, which will take effect on November 30th. All right, let's get to some parent questions. We're going to start off with a parent who actually sent in a recording about how the mandate will exactly work.
Hi, my name is Sarah Williams, and I have one child in the district. I'm going to ask the superintendent, how will families be asked to submit proof of COVID-19 vaccination? Thank you.
So will there be digital vaccination records? And essentially, how would you prevent forgeries? And if will there be punishment or some kind of consequence for forgeries?
You know, we've already started the process of administering a process by which our staff proof is being reviewed. We've hired about 275 additional staff that are doing this kind of work, COVID testing, contact tracing, health screening, care room support, data entry, data integrity as well. We will be announcing what the centralized process is going to look like over the next couple of weeks, but it'll be similar to what we've had to do as staff. For example, we upload vaccination card proof, things like that. It'll be very similar to that for our families. It will be recorded in Infinite Campus, which is our student information system. We have an immunization record, history of immunizations for our families, of course. It'll be very similar to that, but we want to make sure that it's as efficient as possible. And of course, that it's centralized and that we, of course, are very committed to protecting the privacy of all of our students. So it will be part of our student information database system.
Our next question is a parent who has two high school students, and they want to know, how will the kids who remain unvaccinated, how will they be accommodated?
Well, again, if you choose not to get a vaccination and submit proof of that by 11:30, and let me just clarify, Vicky, it's by 11:30, you have to submit proof of your the first dose of the vaccination. And then there's deadlines beyond that, as well as giving 30 days to students once they become eligible, say at age 12, and then 8 weeks after that, the second proof of the second dose. But if you choose not to get vaccinated, there will be a process, again, a centralized process in which you will submit an exemption request. And at that point, we will then make sure that those students, those staff members are undergoing routine COVID testing. Now, I'm not in a position right now to say what the cadence of that testing would look like, because that will be done in consultation with our partners at Sac County Public Health and others. It will be determined by positivity rates throughout the region, positivity rates at that particular school site. So in some cases, it might be weekly. In some cases, hopefully not. It might be even sooner than weekly. But we're hopeful that will continue to be a mitigating piece for us to make sure that we are containing the spread of COVID.
We also have a question from a parent asking about masking requirements after the mandate takes effect.
Hi, my name is Caroline Nasella, and I would like to ask the superintendent if whether or not after kids are vaxxed in the schools, we can expect some sort of flexibility or changes to the mask mandates. And if so, will that depend on the community numbers and spread? Thanks so much.
Yeah, it's an excellent question, Vicky, and you may have heard that CDPH just announced a revision to this mandate, and they are extending the mask mandate until further notice. Our board took, again, a very firm and bold stance in that we are requiring masks both indoor and outdoor. We do have opportunities for students to take mask breaks, and we've designated areas for that. But we do think that that has been a very strong mitigating factor in the low positivity rates that we continue to see. every day I'm able to see a report from our team of the number of new positive cases, and those cases have gone down steadily as we continue the school year. And I believe that that has been one of the reasons why we've seen, you know, fairly low positivity rates and spread of COVID in our school system. Mm-hmm.
There were also parents who had questions about, you know, when talking about a return to normalcy, about opening up more once the mandate goes through.
Hi, my name is Jennifer, and I have two kids in the district. My question is, will field trips and parent volunteers in the classroom be allowed once kids can be vaccinated?
Yeah, another excellent question. We are very happy to have worked with a lot of our staff here and Sac County Public Health. Our students have been demanding for some of this as well, as you can imagine, with homecoming season, with football season. We've put out very pretty firm and strict guidelines for student participation in those kinds of activities. At homecoming dances, they're taking place outdoors. For example, you do have to demonstrate and prove that you've been vaccinated or that you've had a negative result in a COVID test. Prepackaged meals, for example, distancing, safe distancing standards, trying our best to get to that place. You know, I'm very careful about using the word normalcy as superintendent, because there's a lot of things, of course, that I think we need to capitalize and try not to go back to what normal looked like. And in fact, try to change many, many systems that have been put in place that have produced, candidly, very poor results for our students. And we can't just strive for that type of normalcy. But, you know, in the case of athletics, of extracurricular experiential activities, our board was very committed to making sure, for example, that as soon as Sly Park opens up, that we use one-time funds so that every one of our sixth graders can have an opportunity to participate in such a milestone activity that I've heard here in Sacramento for so many of our families and students that they look forward to. But so many of those things are dependent on other factors. And so we're not in a position where we are going to get ahead of CDPH or get ahead of Sac County Public Health, but we are working very closely with them.
From a parent with a student currently in independent studies program, they actually want to ask you what you've learned about adequately planning for families moving in and out of independent studies in the wake of this mandate. Oh, and that was just, she didn't send a recording. She wrote it. That's okay.
Sorry,
I know we're bouncing back and forth.
I was waiting for the recording. Well, it's also a very fair question. And I've said that, you know, the buck stops with me as superintendent. There are decisions that I should have made much sooner about independent study. And I don't want to address some of the challenges that we're all facing related to staffing shortages and those kinds of things. But the reality is that there were a lot of factors that came into being at a time where it made it very difficult for us to be fully prepared for the number of families that might become interested as we were opening our school year. You know, I've heard the vaccination mandate may be a decision. We heard it in public comment, for example, the night that the board took action on this vaccination mandate, that many families might consider bringing back their students to in-person instruction because they enrolled their child in independent study because there was no vaccination mandate or because of the low vaccination rates in our community. I'm very, very hopeful that that, in fact, will be the result of or a result of this vaccination mandate related to independent study. I want to make sure that our parents feel comfortable and confident that our health and safety protocols have kept our students safe and healthy. And I'll say that as a parent myself, I still have three children in Sac City Unified, and both as superintendent, of course, but also as a parent, I'm very confident in those health and safety protocols. Just this week on Monday, my son, one of my twin boys who just entered high school, was coughing, went to our care room, immediately got a rapid antigen test, tested negative, but the school contacted us and said, you know, we'd like you to pick them up in any event because of the coughing. And so we did that. Those are the kinds of measures that we have put in place. And again, I'm hoping that our families will feel much more confident that with this step, as well as all of the health and safety protocols that we've already implemented, that they will feel more comfortable sending their children to in-person instruction.
And your children are vaccinated if they're able to be?
They are. I have a 12-year-old and she got her first vaccination dose on her birthday and just had her second one earlier this week.
Final question before we let you go. I mean, if students leave the district in sizable numbers, that's ultimately going to impact funding. If teachers and school staff leave, that's just going to exacerbate shortages that existed before the pandemic. And I followed the district for several years battling insolvency and state takeover. Does funding and staffing keep you up at night?
It does. And it's a very difficult conundrum and dilemma, Vicky. And I said that I said as much the night that the board took action. I wish that we weren't in a position where we didn't have to consider all of those details as part of this action. But the reality is that, you know, I couldn't in good conscience not talk about those considerations because I am very concerned about the potential loss of enrollment. Again, even though it's happening across the state and we've heard of what's happened in LA Unified and San Francisco and other places, we're down 1,600 students. That's a significant drop in revenue. And I wish that we didn't even have to talk about budget implications when we're talking about public health matters, which is why I've been very clear that if at some future point, community members and others wonder what were they thinking and why didn't they think about the potential loss of enrollment, we're going to have to be very committed in our belief that we did it for the sake of health and safety of our students, which is something that we take very seriously. I'm hopeful that that doesn't happen, Vicky. I've expressed as much to our legislative delegation and policymakers, and the resolution actually calls for me to continue that advocacy to make sure that we are looking at those considerations very seriously from a policy perspective.
Superintendent Aguilar, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And that is Sacramento City Unified Superintendent Jorge Aguilar speaking with us about the district's vaccine mandate that will take effect on November 30th. Up next, a nonprofit that literally peddles for homeless advocacy is expanding beyond Sacramento. We'll check in with Mercy Peddlers 19 months into the pandemic. Also, as the Dixie Fire approaches 1 million acres with that large of a burn scar, we'll explore how this affects animal habitat. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Mercy Peddlers approaches homelessness with a cup of coffee brewed with humanity. The nonprofit was founded by Sister Libby, a longtime advocate for the unhoused community here in Sacramento. Mercy Peddlers does just that. With 2 feet, they provide daily essential needs, and with that respect, relationships build and can lead to services and resources. Sister Libby Fernandez joins us now with that intimate view of homelessness 19 months into the pandemic. Welcome, Sister Libby.
Thank you, Vicki. It's so good to see you and hear your voice. You're doing such a great job on Insight, but you also know what it's like to be a Mercy Peddler. I really thank you for inviting me to represent our many volunteers who are out there serving our homeless in Sacramento.
Yeah, I have followed your nonprofit since the beginning and got out there myself one day. Can you just talk to us about your history of advocacy in Sacramento? Because you really are local and you've been here for with this issue for quite a while.
Oh, yes. I love Sacramento and I've been a Sister of Mercy for 31 years. And 20 of those years, I worked at Loaves and Fishes, which even today is one of the largest campuses serving those who are homeless, poor, and in need of services. And they have 15 programs from mustard seed school to showers for men and women to, of course, feeding our hungry in town. But after 20 years there, I really wanted to continue serving those who are homeless. And so I came up with this concept 4 years ago called Mercy Peddlers. And what we do is we're all volunteers and we actually peddle. We bike or trike and reach those who are homeless on the streets. So we'd go down alleys and sidewalks and downtown and midtown and Carmichael, Arcade. We're even expanding to the town of Stockton. So we have 100 peddlers out there trying to connect one-on-one with those who are experiencing homelessness.
You know, this has been your calling, as you said, for, you know, over three decades. What has changed since you first began pursuing this issue and solving this issue?
Oh my gosh. You know, first of all, we never had homelessness 30 years ago. We had those who are inebriate, skid row, but homelessness wasn't coined but a few, about 20 years ago. And it really did come out of the fact that we closed down the mental health hospitals and the institutions, and we found thousands of people who were on the streets due to mental illness. And now the majority of our folks that we see, there's over 6,000 men and women who are on the streets who are not in shelters. So a couple factors have changed. One is housing costs have gone up so extraordinarily high that if we would even place that as a priority, creating affordable housing for men and women in Sacramento, that would, you know, end half our homelessness issues. And for many people who are on the edge of becoming homeless because they can't afford where they're staying at now. So we definitely need to increase affordable housing with supportive services. Homelessness is such a difficult, complex subject. If we have 6,000 people who are homeless, then you have 6,000 stories and 6,000 reasons and barriers of what keeps people from finding that affordable housing and supportive services. And it can go on and on.
Yeah. And Sacramento arguably is investing more than ever before to solve this crisis with housing. There's also Project Room Key, which is through the state, to house numbers of unhoused residents. But the numbers don't seem to change. Why is that?
As we find a house or a transitional house or a shelter for one family, there's another family who drops off into homelessness. So it's an ongoing battle. And that's why we really need to look at the policy about affordable housing and really tackle it major, major, major amount of building. And of course, we're growing in Sacramento, but the rent is becoming out of control. So to me, that is the number one issue to help solve this growing numbers, is to really build affordable housing, just housing.
Before we let you go, Sister Libby, you celebrated your four-year anniversary at Mercy Peddlers, and you've expanded now to Stockton. Even with your lens and being so tapped into Sacramento, what has surprised you most during this journey with Mercy Peddlers?
The joy of connecting one-on-one with someone. And that's why I think we have so many Mercy Peddlers, is because people want to do something. And if you can look at an individual and touch them in their lives, you feel good about what you're doing. The person you're serving feels good. And so it's a win-win. So what I'm learning is everybody wants to do something. And Mercy Peddlers is one way of reaching out one person at a time, developing that trust and care, real care, and then finding resources to help that person to the next step. And that's a beginning, but I think everyone could do something like that.
Thank you so much, Sister Libby. Nice to see you.
You too. God bless.
That is Sister Libby Fernandez, a longtime advocate for those experiencing homelessness and director of Mercy Peddlers, which celebrated its four-year anniversary. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. The Dixie Fire in five Northern California counties, including Lassen and Plumas counties, has been burning since the middle of July. In 3 months, the wildfire has consumed nearly 1 million acres. The Dixie Fire is now 95% contained, but how does a wildfire with such a massive footprint affect wildlife in the area and their habitat? We have a good hunch it's far from good, but we're going to dive in further. we have Dr. Rachel Blakey, a researcher with UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. Rachel has actually done some research on birds of prey in the area of the Dixie Fire and joins us now. Welcome, Rachel.
Thanks, Vicki. It's great to be here.
Well, Rachel, before we get to the Dixie Fire, you've actually studied how goshawks, a sort of mid-sized gray raptor, were affected by large wildfires. How do you describe this bird of prey?
Yeah, that's a good question. So northern goshawks, they're a fierce apex predator. They're distributed pretty widely across the world in the across the northern hemisphere, including in large expanses of the northern and western parts of North America. So in the Sierra Nevada near us, they tend to rely on what we call old forest attributes. So tall trees, high canopy cover, large diameter trees. And so in the study that we published last year in the Plumas National Forest, we actually found that high severity fires were likely to make habitat unsuitable for them. And this includes both their roosting habitat, which is where they rest during the nighttime, as well as their hunting habitat during the day. And another interesting thing we found in that study was that the areas that they were selecting to roost and hunt in actually overlapped really strongly with areas of high fire risk. And you know, we saw the results of that come into play when the Dixie Fire, you know, burned most of that study area this year.
Yeah. Let's actually send some sound in. Let's take a listen to the northern goshawk. I feel like it's very, like, perforated, you know.
It's kind of unexpected, isn't it? It's not really what you expect a fierce, like, apex predator to say.
Does this concern you when it comes to the hawk population in the Dixie Fire region right now? I mean, any ideas? I mean, really how they fared or where they've gone?
Yeah, so this specific population, thinking more broadly as a species, we're lucky that it is such a widespread species, so it's not going to be threatened with extinction by something like the Dixie Fire at that level. However, across the Western North American coniferous forest part of their distribution, that's where they're more likely to be relying on these old forest attributes. And that's also the area that, as we know from experience, is really prone to severe wildfire and to megafires. So we don't really know the fate of our study population on the Plumas. Our Forest Service project partners at the Plumas National Forest, who I collaborated with the Institute for Bird Populations, they haven't yet been able to assess how many of the protected activity centres, and these are the areas that they're managing to conserve goshawk nesting habitat, were burned at high severity in the Dixie Fire. So this leaves many questions about what happened to them. They're highly mobile, so they can easily fly, you know, miles during a day. But megafires like Dixie, they make their own weather and they can be highly unpredictable. Right. So yeah, it's possible, you know, it is possible that some individuals perished. And for the individuals that escaped the fire, we don't really know whether they would have been able to establish new territory somewhere else and whether these areas would have provided sufficient resources for them to go in and breed. But there are some causes for hope. So our Forest Service partners have indicated that the goshawks have been sighted in some of the more lightly burned areas and some of the areas that they previously managed with underburning that have retained more canopy cover. So, and indeed, you know, in our tracking study that I mentioned earlier, we did see that they were making some forays into lightly burned areas. So there's cause for hope.
Are there any positive impacts to megafires on wildlife?
Yeah, so definitely. It's interesting. So I think it's important to distinguish between megafires and high severity fires. So high severity fire is an essential part of our ecosystems in Western North America, mm-hmm. but megafires are defined as fires like greater than 400 kilometers squared, so 154 square miles. And thinking about the Dixie Fire, that's almost double that threshold. So if we think about high severity fire in general, some really interesting work done by the Institute for Bird Populations observations by Morgan Tingley of UCLA and his student Andrew Stillman, they found that black-backed woodpeckers actually require not just high-severity burned areas, but recently burned, so areas burned at high severity in the last 10 years. And they need this for breeding because the burned trees provide areas for nest making and also an abundance of beetle larvae to feed their young. So this species, the black-backed woodpecker, has actually been called the most fire-associated bird species in the world. And so you would think that the Dixie Fire would be cause for celebration, right, for the black-backed woodpecker. But what's interesting is that even these high-severity fire specialists require some degree of heterogeneity or variation in the burned landscape. So Andrew and Morgan found that they actually really like burned edges. And that's because the recent fledglings that are still being fed by their parents can have some cover from predators while the parents foray out into those beetle-rich areas in the high-severity burn scars to feed them. So, yeah, I think this is, it leads to a really interesting point about the importance of variability in fire regimes.
Yeah, that's such a great point that you just made. We only have about a minute left, but I did hear you're doing more research when it comes to mountain lions and fire. Can you just give us a little teaser on that before we let you go?
Yeah, sure. So I'd love to talk more about this in the future when we've released our results, but we're doing some pretty exciting work where we're looking at the interactions between wildfire and also human influences on mountain lions. So you know that in California, we have a lot of mountain lion populations that are living near humans, such as in Los Angeles and Santa Cruz and various other places. And so we're trying to figure out just how these two pressures interact to influence how these apex predators use the landscape. So hopefully we get to talk more about that in future.
I'd love to have you back on with that, with those findings. Thank you so much, Dr. Blakey.
You're welcome, Vicky. Thanks for having me on.
And that is Dr. Rachel Blakey, a researcher with UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability, sharing research on birds of prey in the area of the Dixie Fire. Still ahead, if you're a fan of Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan, I think you're going to like what's coming up next. Cap Radio Jazz sends us off with Samara Joy, performing this weekend at the Pacific Jazz Festival in Stockton. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Singer Samara Joy is performing this weekend at the Pacific Jazz Festival in Stockton. If you're a fan of Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan, I think you're going to like Samara too. At just 21 years old, her classic style is already drawing comparisons to the legendary singers. Cap Radio Jazz host Andrew Mills has more.
I make a date for golf, and you can bet your life it rains. Try to give a party and the guy upstairs complains. Guess I'll go through life just catching colds and missing trains. Everything happens to me.
Vocalist Samara Joy sounds like she's been singing for decades. But at only 21 years old, she just released her self-titled debut album. I'm Cap Radio Jazz host Andrew Mills. I had a chance to speak with Samara about her impressive accomplishments, which include earning a music degree from Purchase College in New York and receiving accolades from an Academy Award-winning actress. We'll get into that, but first, I wanted to hear about Samara's experience at the 2019 Sarah Vaughan International Jazz Vocal Competition.
Leading up to it, I was just getting into my junior year at Purchase, and I didn't feel ready. I'm not ready to compete with international artists. At first, I didn't want to do it, but I was like, let's just try. When I found out that I was a finalist a couple months later, I was completely shocked. Being a finalist, I was just like, okay, that American Idol moment, like you're going to Hollywood. It was a great experience. I mean, it was really something special. I had an amazing time and was in the mindset, like, let me just sing. I love these songs and I love singing for people. Let me just give it my best shot. The fact that I won, I was like, what? Are you serious?
It only happens once. I'll never feel that thrill again. It only happens once. Why couldn't I have known it then? Since I lost you, dear one, nothing seems to be the same. I try hard, but it's no use. My heart won't play. That now is past.
Samira continues to move forward, and if you're wondering why, the answer is simple.
My relationship with music comes from my family, my grandparents on my father's side, my paternal grandparents. They had a choir called the Savettes of Philadelphia, and I've recently been getting into a lot of their recordings and just hearing my grandmother sing, hear my grandfather sing. He just turned 91 and still going, still singing. To know that I come from that, that's what keeps me going. That's where my love stems from.
Samira also finds inspiration from legendary vocalists Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan, both of whom she's been compared to numerous times.
It's an honor to hear that people think that, but whenever I hear them, I'm like, okay, I got a long way to go. I'm still learning and studying these singers, these wonderful singers, and constantly being inspired by them. Anytime I find a new recording or a song just hits me in a different way. Just listening to Sarah Vaughan sing Stairway to the Stars live at Mr. Kelly's, her natural storytelling and her voice, it's a constant source of inspiration.
Let's build a stairway to the stars and climb that stairway to the stars with love beside us to fill the night with a song.
Despite such lofty comparisons, a prestigious international award, and a seasoned mature sound at 21, Samira only just graduated from the jazz program at Purchase College in New York. If that isn't impressive enough, she didn't even know a great deal about jazz upon entering the program.
When it came time to choose, you know, a school, a college that I wanted to go to, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I knew that I really enjoyed singing, but I wasn't sure if I could actually make, you know, do anything with it. I only auditioned for Purchase and I got in. I ended up being surrounded by musicians who already had a relationship with jazz. Through them, through getting introduced to Louis Armstrong's Stardust and getting introduced to Sarah recordings. And I found a video of Sarah singing live in Amsterdam. And I was like, how can you do that with your voice? And how do I not know about this? Why am I just learning about this? It was a little bit embarrassing. From there, I was completely captured.
An important relationship Samira developed at college is the one she shares with virtuoso guitarist Pasquale Grasso. Featured heavily on her new record, Samira had a lot to say about her experience working with him.
Pasquale is amazing. Fortunately, we've gotten a lot more playing time together since the recording. But even then, I was like, man, this guy's ridiculous. How am I going to keep up with this? And one friend who I sent a track to, he was like, this sounds like if Art Tatum and Ella made a record, or Bud Powell and Ella made a record. I'm like, okay, that's never been done. Let's give it out. So yeah, he's really an amazing musician and even a better person, really good person. So.
And now the purple dusk of twilight time steals across the meadows of my heart. High up in the sky, those little stars climb, always reminding me that we're apart. You wander down the lane and far away, leaving me a song that will not die. Love is now the stardust of yesterday, the music of the years gone by.
Samara Joy is not only catching the attention of world-class musicians, including bassist Ari Rowland and drummer Kenny Washington, who make up her album's rhythm section. Her music has also reached the ears of notable jazz fans around the country, including Academy Award-winning actress Regina King.
So I was taking a break from social media. I only went on those platforms to like check if I had messages about gigs or something. Just check my messages and go. And I saw a message that was like, Regina King was so right. You're really great. And I was like, Regina King? So I checked Google and I was like, let me just see. So I put her name and my name, and then the Hollywood Reporter came up and the transcript from the video had my name, her saying my name, and I was like, I skipped through that video so fast. I was like, where is it? I think the question was, how have you been coping during the pandemic? Because this was a virtual roundtable. Regina King said, you know, I really love this singer, and I recently discovered this young woman. She looks like she's about 16 years old, and Ella and Sarah, she sounds just like them. Her name is Samara Joy. And I was like, oh! I could not even believe that she said my name. And then I proceeded to watch it 50 more times. And every single time I listened to it, I got goosebumps.
With more concerts, international tour dates, and albums on the horizon, this is just the beginning for Samara Joy. For Cap Radio, I'm Andrew Mills.
Samara Joy performs this Saturday with pianist Sullivan Fortner at the Pacific Jazz Festival in Stockton. You can hear Andrew's conversation with Samara and other exceptional musicians at capradio.org/jazz. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We're going to close with Samara Joy's If You Never Fall in Love with Me. Thank you to producer Cynthia Lopez and Pauline Bartoloni, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday. Enjoy Samara Joy. For two, and we'll find joys no lovers ever knew. I wanna stay here by your side and keep your arms forever occupied. Don't you see what a lost lady I'm liable to be if you never fell in love with me? Come through, say that you're mine. I'll make your life one great big Valentine. We'll build a new love world for two, and we'll find joys no lovers ever knew. I wanna stay here by your side and keep your arms forever occupied. Don't you see what a lost lady I'm liable to be? I live a life of ecstasy if you ever fell in love with me.